Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 25-26 Summer Mescun, a mix of literary happenings. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing a potpourri of subjects and authors of historical fiction. There'll be some recent novel launches and a couple of wild cards. So, lay back in the sun, slap on the tanning butter, sip on something long and cool and laced with mint, and listen to your summer fling. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. In February 2026, Sue Williams launched her fourth novel, The Duke's Secret, at the rowdy pub The Hero of Waterloo in Sydney's Rocks District, for reasons that will soon become apparent.
Welcome, everyone. Give it up for the amazing, authentic band, Pump and Pyro. Thank you so much, guys. That is amazing. Okay, welcome, everyone. I want to kick off by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we eat here today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I want to welcome elders past, present, and emerging. This is and always will be Aboriginal land, so thank you. So my name is Wendy Rattray, and I would love to welcome you here to The Hero of Waterloo. And as everyone knows, including me as of last night, that's another name for the Duke of Wellington. So some housekeeping, we have a very generous open bar this evening, so help yourself until the money runs out, and then you need to pay yourself. And we've got some nibbles coming round already. There'll be more nibbles after the speeches. So thank you so much to the amazing band, once again, Pump and Pyro, playing some really beautiful, authentic folk music from the era. So let's talk about the Duke of Wellington. So he's probably most famous for the Battle of Waterloo, where he kicked Napoleon's ass in 1815. Now, it was a very, very bloody war. About 68,000 men either died or were wounded during this awful war. And it's quite fitting that I'm here today to introduce Sue, because we also met on the battlefield in King's Cross at a boxing class probably about 10 years ago. Now, tonight we're going to talk about the Duke of Wellington and one of his lesser well-known stories. And the story is about an affair that he had with his mate, which led to another less well-known branch of his family. So quite a saucy story Sue has written there. I want to also say that we've got books on sale. The signature is also free of charge, so please buy up big. Now, I'm going to welcome Sue on the stage in just a second. Now, Sue may very well be the Duke of Wellington's great-great-great-great-great granddaughter. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Sue Wellington to the stage. She celebrates probably her 50th book that she's written. So Sue, welcome. Gosh, this is so intimidating.
So you can see Wellington boots, trousers, jacket. All from Temu. Very true. Hello. Thank you so much for coming. Good evening. And thanks for joining in the celebration of this latest book, The Duke Secret. It's just wonderful to see so many friends and family here. We've had some people travelling from as far away as Scotland to be here. And some from Mexico. And some from Port Macquarie. And some from Wentworth Point. And for most of the rest of us, it's making a huge effort to leave the eastern suburbs. So thank you. It's much appreciated. So this book is a huge departure for me, being a book about an historical figure from Britain who was at one stage hailed as the hero of the world, the vanquishing Napoleon at Waterloo, which is why we couldn't think of a better place than this pub to mark the launch, the hero of Waterloo, along with Pump and Pie, the fabulous band, playing music reminiscent of that era. Thanks, guys. You're fabulous. And the name Wellington is honoured in many ways, apart from the defeat of Napoleon. There's the waterproof gumboots, like mine, and poisonous dishes you serve to the relatives you don't like. Yeah. The reason I decided to write about him, as Wendy said, is that it's the legend in our family that we are descended from the Iron Duke. Our father has always talked about it, and we've always just ignored him, really. But now I've been spending a lot more time with him, so decided to look into it. And yes, indeed, our four times great-grandmother was a maid in his household who mysteriously fell pregnant just as he was departing for the first long battle campaign against the French in Spain and Portugal. The father was never named, but was popularly believed to be the Duke, who had a huge reputation as a notorious womanizer. But the maid was never sacked, as would have been usual in that time, and the daughter was brought up in the Duke's mansion as well. So this book is the story of the Duke, the maid, that fateful liaison, and their daughter who ended up running away with the butler. Now, the butler was a man called William Williams, which has ever since been the name of the firstborn son in our family. Tonight, my dad, William Williams, unfortunately can't be here, but my brother, Stephen William Williams, is, as well as his son, William Williams, over there. It's lovely to see you. And it's also the story of a contemporary Australian journalist, not a million miles away from me, really, investigating the family legend. But she has far many more affairs than I did, really, Ginny. I just had to make her a bit more interesting than me. So I just finally wanted to thank my publisher, Annette Barlow, from Allen Unwin, fabulous editor, Krista Munns, who's here. And congratulations, she's just got married. It's fantastic. And publicist Sam Ryan, my agent Fiona English. So just want to say, enjoy the authentic music, enjoy the drinks while it lasts, enjoy the food in this authentic location. And rest assured, the mushrooms in the arancini balls have no relation to that murderous beef Wellington. But thank you.
Thank you. The next morning, Sue was interviewed by James Dunbar about some of the stories behind the story.
So here we are. We meet on a podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a pleasure to be here. And I hope everybody enjoys listening to my questions and your answers and understand my accent.
Okay.
So you've written three books of historical fiction before, Elizabeth and Elizabeth, That Bly Girl, and The Governor, His Wife and His Mistress. But this one is very different. In what way?
Well, they were always about Australian colonial, early colonial times. And this time I've gone further afield. And it's half in Britain at the time of the Duke of Wellington, which is obviously the late 18th century and early 19th century, plus a contemporary Australian. So there's a dual narrative there. I've never done a dual narrative before. So it's actually quite a different book in some ways, although probably people who like the first three books hopefully will like this one as well.
I know this has got a personal connection to you. Can you just explain what it is?
My father has always talked about the legend in our family that we're descendants of the Duke of Wellington. And so I really thought I would look into that.
But you've always treated it as a bit of a joke.
Well, yeah, because we never really took it seriously. And then when I actually looked into it and discovered that a maid in his household was actually my four times great-grandmother who fell pregnant mysteriously. So I realised that maybe there was much more to this than met the eye. And so that's when I started investigating, realised that there was something there.
How did you find out this?
Well, I had a family access to a family tree done by my grandfather's brother. And he had a woman called Mary Ann Marshall at the top. And Mary Ann Marshall had a baby at exactly the time that the Duke, she was also with the census results. She was working in the Duke of Wellington's household,
right,
as his maid. And she had a baby and the father was never named at the exact time he was leaving to go to the Peninsular War to fight the French. So most people kind of felt that at that time, when you were going off to war, you had no idea if you were ever going to come back again. And people did desperate things, and it may well have been that they ended up getting together, even though he was married to another woman.
Right.
And that's when she had the baby, because it was so unusual that she would be kept in the household, because the subsequent censuses showed us that she was still in the household and the baby was still in the household as well.
Which was unusual.
Very unusual, because normally you would have been kicked out. An unmarried woman having a child, you'd be kicked out in disgrace and you'd probably, you know, end up being a sex worker on the streets, really, because there was no other way to earn a living because no other respectable family would employ you.
Right. This is the first time you've done a dual narrative across several hundred years. How hard was that to write?
It was incredibly hard, really. I'd never done anything like that before, and I take my hat off to other people who do it. Sometimes, I mean, some people do, you know, quadruple narratives over different time periods, and it actually is really tricky. But I thought it worked really, really well in the end, although it was really painful at the time. And I found the best way to do it. I started off doing it, writing one chapter for the maid and the Duke of Wellington's household, and then the next chapter for my contemporary Australian character, and then the next chapter for the others. And then I discovered that it was too hard to keep going from one century to another. So I ended up writing a few chapters of the maid and Duke of Wellington story, and then writing a few chapters of the contemporary story, and then mixing and merging them,
right,
and then going back later to try and mesh them at various times so they might have different times in common. For instance, when the contemporary Australian character, which is Lucy based on me, she's a journalist like me and a writer like me, when she went to Paris to investigate the time after the Battle of Waterloo, what it was like when the Duke of Wellington went there to become the ambassador, I made the previous chapter the chapter when the Duke of Wellington went to Paris and right, became the ambassador. So tried to kind of mesh it, and I did that afterwards. And I think for most writers, you kind of panic a little bit and you kind of try and do everything all at once. But, you know, I often forget that you can stop and then take a breath and then go back. And I'd always advise other writers to do that as well, to just get a little bit of distance between themselves and the story, read it and then go back and then fix those kind of things that need to be fixed to give it much more of a melded flavour, really.
So you interlace the stories by using little hooks of time
That's
and
right.
place and that kind of thing.
That's right, yeah. Because for the book, I was really keen to understand the Duke of Wellington's character. So I ended up travelling all around Europe through Spain and Portugal and France and obviously through Ireland and through England to trace his early beginnings. I mean, we all know that he was Irish originally, but he always, I mean, one of his famous sayings is being born in a stable does not make one a horse because he was Irish, but he was more English than most English people, really. So it was really important for me to go to Ireland and see what that was about and then travel through Britain to go. I visited all his different houses that he lived in England. He ended up in Apsley House in London, which is the address is 1 London. You know, it's right on Hyde Park,
right,
a magnificent place. And the current Duke of Wellington still lives there today. And the house is often open to visitors as well.
Okay.
Because it's a massive place.
You're first three historical novels, apart from Elizabeth MacArthur to some extent, most of the characters were not terribly widely known.
Mm.
The Duke of Wellington is known around the world.
Yeah.
There's statues in just about every city in Europe. Larger than life, well known. How did that affect the way that you wrote about him?
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody knows about the Battle of Waterloo, and most people know about all the other battles he fought in, perhaps not the detail. And you know, I went into a little bit of detail here and there, but not too much to kind of bore readers, I don't think. But I tried to bring a real personal side to him to try and outline his character and what I think he might have been like. I mean, it's obviously really difficult for me as a 20th century or 21st century woman to kind of work out what somebody like that was about. But I think from his circumstances and from his behaviour and from his writings as well, we can tell an awful lot. I mean, he was a very kind of wise and quite funny man, and he was also very impatient with people. He was married, but he had a terrible marriage. He married a woman called Kitty Pakenham, and he had proposed to her twice before, and her brother had turned him down twice because it obviously wasn't up to her in those days who she married. It was up to her brother. Her brother turned him down twice. And then finally he proposed a third time when he'd come back from one of the battles quite victorious and he had a bit more of a reputation. So the brother said yes this time. So then he married Kitty, but he hadn't seen her for 12 years. You know, they'd grown up together, they'd known each other in Ireland. He had no idea about her and she had no idea about him. So in lots of ways, the marriage was kind of doomed to failure. And the Duke became a notorious womanizer, really. But when you look at the kind of things he said, he was always incredibly funny. He was very impatient with his soldiers. At the beginning, he called them the scum of the earth. And then he said, but what fine soldiers we have made them. I don't know what effect these men will have upon the enemy, but by God, they frighten me. And he always said the only thing he's afraid of is fear. And of Napoleon, he was really quite admiring of him in some ways, in the same way that Napoleon was admiring of the Duke of Wellington. Wellington said of Napoleon, his presence on the field, this is the Battle of Waterloo field, made the difference of 40,000 men because he was such a great leader of men into battle. And then, of course, after the Battle of Waterloo, one would imagine that the Duke of Wellington was quite triumphant, but at the same time, he was quite devastated at the loss of life. And he said something that always really struck me, nothing except a battle lost can be half as melancholy as a battle won. So he was quite a wise man. After that was the last battle he ever fought. And then he went into politics. And he was kind of a bit of a disaster really in politics. And I think if I just give one more quote, you'll see exactly why he was a disaster. I mean, he became British Prime Minister briefly, but when he went to his first meeting, he said he found politics an extraordinary affair. I gave them their orders and they wanted to stay and discuss them. So you can see he wasn't terribly democratic man. You know, he was an army man, so he was used to giving orders and having them obeyed immediately.
So you've got one character, the Duke, who's incredibly well known. You've got another character who is real, but we know very little about her. So she is, to all intents and purposes, a fictional character. So how did you approach writing about the maid, Mary Ann Marshall?
I did a huge amount of research into what a maid's life would have been like in those days, in that area in London, in that age. People's attitudes, what kind of duties they did, where she'd be on the rung of the household. She started out right on the bottom rung, but she moved her way up, we know. The big question really, so you think, what was life like? What would have been life? Who would she have socialised with? The other maids, the other butlers, the people around her. But the big question is, why would the maid and the Duke of Wellington have slept together? And we still cannot be sure about that. Look, it could have been something like rape. It could have been non-consensual. I prefer to think that maybe was consensual because he treated women with real respect. He had lots of women friends as well as female lovers. So I would like it to think that it was done with real respect. And obviously when a man in a position like the Duke of Wellington approaches a young maid, it's pretty hard to say no, really. Maybe it's kind of fortune hunting, but maybe it's just being overwhelmed by the majesty of that man and his power and his fame. Well, I mean, we see that so much.
It's a classic power imbalance, isn't it?
That's right.
Seeing played out in the news at the moment.
That's right.
Your contemporary character, who is truly fictional, or is she, Ava Washington?
Well, she has a lot in common with me because she's a journalist and she's frustrated. She writes a lot about property, and I'm a journalist and I write a lot about property, but I'm not terribly frustrated because I quite enjoy doing that. And I do lots of other news and travel and stuff. And then I write books, which I absolutely love. And my character, Ava, has a father she barely knows. And really, I know my father very well, but I've never had an awful lot to do with him throughout my life. It's always been my mother. My father was always kept in the background in lots of ways. And Ava really wants a way of connecting with her father. So when her father tells her the legend of the Duke of Wellington, she decides to investigate it. And she becomes much closer to her father as a result. And to be honest, I think that's what's happened to me as well, because Dad, now I've handed him the book and he's read the book, he's kind of really interested in it, and we can actually have conversations about it now as well. So there are lots of things, but my character Ava is much more interesting than me. She has a terrible relationship with an awful man. She finds another man, but she's torn between the two. And I've been very happily married for, 36 years or something now. So I don't have that in common with her, but Ava does lots of things that I did. She travels all around Europe to track down the Duke of Wellington everywhere he went. She also explores the DNA connection. She tries to get in touch with the current Duke of Wellington to get his DNA, as exactly I did as well. And when I went to London one time, I had dinner with some university friends, and one friend has done extremely well and she's ended up in the House of Lords. And I was telling her about this book and she said, I sit next to the Duke of Wellington in the House of Lords. And I thought, wow, it's a sign. And I said, can you get me some DNA? Can you get me a hair off his jacket or a glass that he's just drunk out of? And she said, yes, that will be fine. And then her husband, who's a well-known barrister, said, you can't possibly do that. It's highly illegal. So unfortunately, I ended up writing him a letter, which she passed on to him. And then I also got in touch with his niece, who is also a writer, and I thought she might be sympathetic too. So she explores the DNA connection and also the family trees connection going on to ancestry.com as well as the things that I did too.
And does she find out if they are related?
I can't possibly tell you that. You have to read the book to discover it.
So was it hard going from an late 18th century mindset, and that's an era with which, after three books, now four with the next one that you've written, you're quite familiar, going from that to the first quarter of the 21st century?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. The contemporary part was much easier to write because it's so much more familiar. But for historical fiction writers, as most people will know, who are listening to this podcast, it's really much harder to write historical fiction because you have to be absolutely accurate, because I'm sure there's going to be readers out there looking for inaccuracies and you're always very, very nervous about those readers. But unfortunately, they exist, I'm sure. So the historical part is much harder to write, I think. But at the same time, the research is really important, and you've got lots of books. You've got newspaper reports of the time, which are really important to look at. And now with the age of the internet, it's fantastic because Trove has so much which is transcribed, which is much easier. Because, for instance, when I was in Southampton, like Ava was, that's where the Duke of Wellington's archive is held. And there are over 100,000 items in the archive, and that's all letters and notes that he has written. So I travelled there and you can only look at a few. You have to apply to look at them. So you never quite know what you're going to get. Sometimes you just get a shopping list, you know, or I got an order for his valet to run him a bowl of hot water for his feet, that kind of thing, which is not terribly useful. But that kind of just gives you an insight into people's characters at that time. And I also interviewed lots of experts on the era. At Glasgow University, there's an archaeologist who specialises in battlefield archaeology, and he's done a lot of work on the battlefield at Waterloo. So I interviewed him and read a book which is kept at the archive at Glasgow University, which is the first person to go onto the battlefield after the actual battle itself who wasn't a soldier. And he was a merchant. And his book is just so colourful. I mean, it's just extraordinary, really, talking about wading through the blood on the battlefield. You know, up to 68,000 people were died and injured there. I mean, it was horrendous. And that kind of gives you the colour that you need for the book as well, I think. And for the DNA, I interviewed one of Australia's leading DNA experts, Dr. Dadna Hartman, at the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine. And I've always found those experts, they're really generous with their knowledge normally, and they're actually quite happy to be contacted by a writer because it's something a bit different and they're usually really interested in it. So with historical fiction, I find you have to do as much research as you possibly can and then often strip out that research so you don't bore the reader, but make it feel that it's very authentic and that you're writing from a position of real knowledge, so they feel safe in your hands.
Does your background as a journalist help with that?
Definitely. It definitely helps, but in other ways it can be a hindrance because fiction is so different to non-fiction. Mm. And I think with the first book, Elizabeth and Elizabeth, I really struggled with veering away from historical fact to kind of create conversations and create colour. But now I'm getting much more used to it. And I love using the historical facts as the benchmark and the basis for stories, but then weaving more colour and emotion and empathy around those facts.
And you won't tell us what the ultimate result of the DNA tests are, but are you happy with the end result of the book?
Yeah, I'm really happy. I'm really exhausted, but I'm really relieved and happy and really proud of it. And there's been a few reviews. Books and Publishing did the first review and then some people on Goodreads. And they've all been very favourable, which has been fantastic. And I think any writer, you get really nervous as soon as you hand in the final manuscript. And you think, oh, my God, is this going to be a disaster? I never know whether it's any good or not. And so it's wonderful when you do get some good reviews. And hopefully those continue.
Now, your next historical fiction is already in the pipeline. That's MacArthur's Daughters.
That's right, yeah.
But you've dabbled your toes in modern contemporary fiction. Do you see yourself going back to that at some point?
Well, my first love, I think, is always going to be historical fiction. But I can imagine perhaps in the future doing this dual narrative again with a contemporary character and a historical character. And I think that would be, that's a really hard but incredibly rewarding thing. So maybe that's a possibility as well.
Okay. Well, thanks, Sue. That has been really enlightening and informative.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Jimmy.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025-26 Summer Mesklun. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Remember to slip, slop, slap this summer and keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.